From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Media Project is underway, an opportunity for a half hour of commentary, analysis, and when we are on our game, even some insight into the news media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, with a full crew this morning. Off in the woods there by remote, there's Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. There you are. Are you out there, sir? Sir?
We are, and we're buried in snow, which is why I'm not with you in person. But there's a fifth panelist, and that's Murray the dog, and you may hear him barking in the background.
Wow, that would be great to get some good common sense from Great Barrington. Speak, Murray, speak. All right. And sitting in his usual seat there, here is Ian Pekus, the news director of WAMC. Sir.
Good morning, good afternoon, whenever you're listening to us. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, how about that? Great to have you on the show here. And the one and only genuine original, Judy Patrick, editor of the Daily Gazette. A short timer, actually. You're not going to be doing that job much longer.
Yeah, a few more weeks. But as always, I'm delighted to be here in WAMC and all the other affiliated stations. Too numerous to mention.
Too numerous. Yeah, you could do the station IDs probably, too, since we've heard them so much. We can go through the line. That would be fun. Oh, there's a little cheat sheet for those of you. I thought you guys had it all memorized. Anyway, it's a great thing.
The magic of radio.
Radio is wonderful. You know, nobody can tell that we're just, you know, reading from a script here. Precisely every word that we say is rehearsed and perfectly put together.
Yes, you're right, Rex.
As usual.
And I wanted to just say, I certainly hope Judy will be joining us post-editorship, because she is one of the most knowledgeable people about the press that I know. And I hope you'll say on the radio right now that when you're available and when you're around, you'll be on.
You call my name and I'll be there.
Great. Sounds to me like a song.
All right. So here comes a letter. We always invite people to send us mail, media@wamc.org. And Charles in Stamford, Connecticut writes to us saying that I want to thank and compliment you on what has become my favorite show to listen to. The Media Project is an outstanding half hour of news and media talk. He's a print newspaper junkie, he says, so he appreciates when we focus on the industry. Between that and Rex's laugh, Alan's humor, and the theme song, thank you, Pete. I'm constantly listening to new episodes and the archives. Thank you for producing such great content. Isn't that nice? How about that?
It's wonderful.
But he actually does have some real issues he wants us to address. Number one, and we may not be able to answer all these questions, what's the future of USA Today in print? He says he's been reading it since the late 80s, and it has dwindled to 6 to 8 pages per section, 8 to 10 stories in the front news section. They are, of course, making a push to digital, but wouldn't it be in the best interest to maintain a healthy flagship paper? Good question. You know, a lot of USA Today's funding for the print edition comes from hotels who give it out, and that's been dwindling, I believe. So there may be less of that to go around. There's not a lot of advertising there, right?
And remember how innovative USA Today was when it first came out. New ways of presenting the news. It got dissed by a lot of traditional journalists, but it became very popular in airports and hotels, but you do see it less frequently. Then again, you are seeing it more in the regional Gannett papers. They're slipping. They're using that news to distribute it that way. It would be sad to see it decline.
Wasn't there a problem with Gannett robbing Peter to pay Paul? They were so interested in making USA Today their flagship that they began to take from their regional papers in order to make USA Today stronger. Am I wrong about that?
There was some of that going on. Absolutely. They borrowed reporters from local newspapers to launch the paper, and it worked out well for them at the start. And actually, we shouldn't diss USA Today entirely, because they did some really good investigative reporting over the last few years. During the campaign, they had great stuff on Donald Trump.
But stylistically, Rex, they didn't go on as long as other newspapers did. They tried to keep their stuff short and pithy, P-I-T-H-Y.
Well, to Judy's point, I think we've learned from them, and we are all trying to be a little bit shorter and more Pithy, P-I-T-H-Y.
Right. Yeah. I think at one point, you know, doing something in the USA style was a pejorative, but we have learned that people aren't going to read all 30 or 40 or 50 inches of our copy. They will if it's really interesting, but there is an advantage. That's why it was so popular at one point.
And to speak to what Gannett's doing nationally, they have this idea now of becoming a distributor, a national distributor, somewhat like the Associated Press aims to be, getting the stories out on the Gannett News Service or the USA Today Network, as they're calling it. So you can tell, like most of the other outlets, they're starting to look toward digital. I don't want to say digital only, but digital primarily future.
Which actually goes to the next question from Charles in Stamford, who says, New York Times CEO Mark Thompson said on CNBC, I like this, by the way, when people attribute where they see things. Said on CNBC that he could see the paper remaining in print for the next 10 years. What do you see as its future? For example, would there be, at the very least, a Sunday print edition? And along those lines, what about local papers like Rex, your Albany Times Union, or the Connecticut Hearst papers in his area? Can they remain 7 days a week in print? I think the answer to that is no. I think there will come a time when you will not have 7 day a week print papers. In the probably not too distant future, a decade or a little bit more. Already, of course, in some cities like Syracuse, for example, the Newhouse newspaper group has Syracuse is really a real full newspaper, only I think 3 days a week. They've done that in Mobile, Alabama, and Newark, New Jersey, and the Oregonian in Portland and elsewhere. So I think there will come a time when, as the people who prefer print
die.
It's less, somehow it's less harsh when you say it, Alan, than when those of us who are younger. It's very kind of you. But it's true. As we lose that audience.
As they pass on.
Yes. Go to camp. We will probably have fewer people. And you know, the transition is happening. We're seeing more and more everywhere. Well, and I think it's probably true for radio, too, isn't it? You're building your digital.
We have to. And we know that when we put a show out from start to finish for 1 hour, it's a high quality program that's interesting at 1210 and 1250. But are people tuning in at 1214 precisely to find out the latest at Albany City Hall? Not necessarily.
Right.
So we've got to meet them where they are. I will say, I teach a class at the University at Albany, and I bring in print products for my students who otherwise usually don't have access to them or really know what they are, and they always take them. So maybe that's an affectation. I don't know. Maybe it makes them look cool to walk around with the Daily News. But the 20-somethings, if you offer them the print product for free, are still taking it.
Or maybe, Ian, just maybe, as a teacher for 40 years, they want to impress you and have a higher grade.
That's also possible, and it's working.
You know, I would have said 5 years ago that the papers would be around for another 20, but I don't think so. I find myself more and more reading online. The paper, I have to throw it away. It's big, and I don't see the younger generation picking it up. Then again, we still get requests from young people for reprints if they're on the front page. It still matters to them.
Right. That's exactly right. You know, there was some research, I guess it was about 10 years ago on college campuses, when we were considering creating a special product for the campuses, and we thought we could do something about that. And there was research suggesting that students would pick up a print product if they thought that it was an alternative that nobody else knew about. They were looking for something that was uniquely theirs. So you weren't supposed to have racks. You weren't supposed to have organized distribution. You were supposed to have stuff kind of sloppily lying around, and people would pick it up and think they had something cool there. So we weighed that, and it turns out, interestingly, for young people, there is not an appetite for advertising. Advertisers were not eager to try to reach these college students. They thought that there wasn't enough disposable income there, I guess.
And yet, how about all those journalism majors? Young people who come into college and they say, I want to be a journalist, even with all this adverse news you're laying out for us, Rex.
Well, it's because there are other avenues other than what we call the lanes, not lamestream, the, that was a flaw, the legacy media, other than us folks. And besides that, journalism is a great major because it teaches people to synthesize information, write quickly and well, and be informed on the issues of the day. So even if a person is not going to be a journalist, I think it is a useful major.
You hear a lot of the students saying, I want to be a creator. I want to be a YouTube channel star. And that's fine. That's where things are going. Huh. They're doing that under the journalism umbrella.
In my newsroom, we are starting to call people content creators.
Whoa.
Well, you know, maybe in reports.
Uh-huh.
But because they're not all reporters. There are digital editors who are creating content. There are photographers who are creating new kind of content. So, you know, they are creating content. there will always be a need for content. It's just that printed paper will probably go away.
You know, this goes back actually to that conversation about USA Today. Gannett pioneered the use of these odd new titles in newsrooms, and maybe they knew what they were talking about. We really resisted it. I like these good old-fashioned newsroom titles. But they had local content director was the editor of a newspaper, right? And some of those titles.
And we don't call our audience readers. We call them our audience because we have the problem that they're not all reading. Some of them are watching or listening.
Some of them are wrapping fish.
Which comes to the third and final question from Charles in Stamford, who says, do you have access to current circulation numbers for newspapers? Up until a few years ago, you could find an audit a couple times a year. But it seems now that they include the online edition, it's harder to find actual print numbers. And I'll tell you that I literally do not know our actual print circulation of my newspaper. It is not a number that sticks out. You know, I used to always have this number, well, 104 daily, 160 Sunday, and it's probably half that. I don't know. I literally don't know what the numbers are anymore.
You know, we used to print it on our front page every day.
Really?
Back in the day when it was above 70,000. And now how they measure it, they will bring in the if you pay for a digital subscription, they'll add it into your number. So you get an artificially inflated number when you're thinking it's actual print subscribers. Then again, newspapers used to always multiply by three our actual print.
Right.
Three people are reading this newspaper.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I always thought that was what they did with Penthouse, but I didn't know it was done with newspapers.
I don't know what you're talking about. You know, by the way, part of the difficulty is that there are different ways of stating circulation and audience because it depends on what advertisers want. And so the way one newspaper counts it, another one does not. We don't count in any of our numbers the people who are add-ons, who add digital to their print subscription. We don't count that as a second piece of circulation, and some newspapers do. But there are different categories that you can use to explain it, and the advertisers understand this. They know what they're buying, but ordinarily consumers do not. So it's a bit of a misleading thing. Anyway, thank you, Charles in Stamford, for offering us some thoughtful questions and getting us launched here. If you want to share your thoughts, it's media@wamc.org. We are the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Judy Patrick of the Daily Gazette, Alan Shartok and Ian Pickus of WAMC, and I'm Rex Smith from the Times Union, so we are grateful to you. Here's an interesting bit of ethical questioning that comes from primarily broadcast news over the past week. There was this former Trump campaign aide named Sam Nunberg, who suddenly appeared on television telling every reporter who would listen that he had been subpoenaed by Robert Mueller and that he wasn't going to comply. And he went on and on from one studio to the next, and it was seemingly quite erratic. And the question finally that Katie Tour of NBC posed, I think she was on MSNBC, was, I smell alcohol in your breath. Have you been drinking? And it does come to a question of what our responsibility is in dealing with a source who is erratic or who may be drugged or drunk.
Okay, so I have a question for Ian Pickus, our wonderful news director. Ian, here's my question. Mr. Number calls you up and says, could I be on your show? Your first answer is going to be, yes, of course, isn't it?
I think it has to be in this situation, and maybe because the rules have changed in this administration. This is a newsmaker. It's a high-profile interview, and I think more on the commercial side than what we do at public radio, this was ratings gold for anybody who put him on the air. These videos went viral immediately. You couldn't turn them off. And I think it would be naive to suggest that anyone wasn't putting that as part of the calculus in airing them.
Right. But part of the issue was the fact that he went on, and it was live. It was not anything you could edit. At one point, he called Sarah Huckabee Sanders a big fat slob, a big fat liar. He got very personal on it, and it wandered.
Which part of that wasn't right?
It's never correct to make it personal. These ad hominem attacks, as we call them, is just. But anyone watching would clearly see that it was like listening to a guy at a bar talk. He was just wandering. But obviously, he was a campaign aide. He had been subpoenaed. This was clearly news to get on. But what I felt uneasy about was how it went on, and they just let him hang himself in a number of ways.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, a couple of days later, it turns out the famous now Seychelles meeting, which is absolutely germane to whether or not there's a Russian connection to the Trump campaign and then to the Trump presidency, was something that Nunberg knew about. And so therefore, he becomes a very important witness, is why Mueller is bringing him before the grand jury, apparently.
You know, it's an interesting thing. If you're doing a live show, which, of course, cable is 24/7, what are you going to do if you have something there that where you because we who have the luxury of not having to be live, we are rarely digitally live for Times Union content. We have the luxury of saying, you know, let's think about this ethically, and at what point does this devolve into looking at a crash scene? But it's almost an impossible situation for live presentation, right?
Yeah, but I want to go to your point. Does this mean that newspapers as we know them, you know, are sort of behind the eight ball because they can't do in-the-moment news? They can summarize it. They can say what the guy said the day before. But doesn't it put them at a terrific disadvantage? And doesn't it add to the sort of pomposity that people like you and Judy engage in, which is we're better than the other people because we don't do that kind of thing?
Well, it does give us an opportunity to be pompous and to be better. Yes, thank you.
So what? But was it really? I mean, the news was that he was subpoenaed and he was going to defy it. But what else was news? Where else was the news there other than he was erratic? There was news there, certainly, but the other 25 minutes of him drinking from an empty cup of tea was not news. It was erratic. It was not news anymore.
Besides that, Alan, it's true that we are in print, but as we were just saying, we are increasingly blurring those lines of the platforms we're on. And sure. So I think you'll see the brand Times Union, the brand Gazette, just as the brand WAMC is moving from all live to being available on demand whenever you want it. We will be doing more live instead of being just ink on crushed trees landing on your doorstep. So you'll see more of that as time goes by. I think we're all going to be blurring the lines, and it's going to just become what content creator, what brand of journalism are you going to buy into? And you'll get whatever platform that stuff's being delivered on.
So I had been thinking for a while and actually reached out for a grant, which we didn't get, to establish something called the Center for Convergence. Meaning that let's bring together all the opportunities for all of the various media who are coming together, as you have just suggested. Don't you think that's a good idea? And don't you think somebody out there might want to fund it?
I think it is being funded. I think there are a lot of grants available to assist cross-media development. And the difficulty is for those of us in the, let's say, privately funded media, the commercial media, as our revenues diminish and yet we realize we have to reach out to other platforms, it's the difficulty of making those choices. But I think there is funding available to help startups, for example, to reach across media platforms.
Without question. However, that's not what I was talking about. I was talking about a center with an academic component, which for the entire field acts as a clearinghouse for all of this information. That's what I was thinking.
That sounds like the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism.
Which you graduated from your class from.
This wonderful outfit that is a multimedia. You know, by the way, one of the interesting elements of that I just learned yesterday, and this tells us something about what's happening with journalism in this country and internationally. 40% of the Columbia students are international. 30% of those in the major program, the MS program, are international. And so they're talking about internationalizing the curriculum because a lot of American journalists are now working for foreign-based publications, and a lot of foreign-based publications want to have American journalistic standards. And so there is a lot of international conversation going on. It's why, you know, a few years ago, it was odd to hear a foreign accent on the radio. And now, you know, we listen to public radio and it's who knows what kind of accents we might hear, right?
Are you only saying that because I come from Manhattan?
Well, Ian, in the course you teach, do you do multi-platform? Is it you just do radio or what do you teach?
Yeah, it has to be all of the above. And I would say the students who have been most successful in any of the classes I've been a part of have been the ones to embrace all platforms. Young people today have an almost instinctual understanding of how they like to consume media. And the ones who are ambitious know how to make it. They don't just go do the campus radio station, but they're doing a podcast at the same time and filming themselves for YouTube. And we hope learning how to write in the process. So I do think it's all of the above for them. And it has to be.
Yeah. You know, there are a couple of problems that are identified with the emerging, the new journalists coming along. One is, of course, that in local journalism, it's not really remunerative. The pay scales are low, and so it doesn't attract really a lot of great students, right? That's problematic.
Well, you have to be upfront about it. And I think, you know, everyone here came through it. You know, it's hard when you're starting out. You're going to have roommates. You're going to work tough hours. And I think if you go into it understanding that, then the benefits are hugely rewarding.
No, it's dramatically different for your generation than it was for mine, because my cost of college was so much lower. Journalism graduates today are emerging from school with this massive debt. And when they come to a paper and don't get paid very well, they really struggle. Many of them are eligible for food stamps.
Mm-hmm. And let's not forget that they can always go over, and many of them do, to the dark side. In other words, they'll go over to be flex and PR people, and they'll get sometimes twice as much money or more.
There are a lot more PR people in this country than there are journalists now, which may tell us something about the progress of the communication industry here and what people are consuming. You know, the place that is hardest for us right now in hiring is diversity. I believe in the value of a diverse newsroom, but here's just a new study that found out that the smallest percentage are women of color in the media. Just below 8% of U.S. print newsrooms, 12.6% of the local TV staff, and 6.2% of local radio staff are women of color. It is very hard to recruit minority journalists, especially women for minority groups.
I agree. It's always been hard. It's something we want to do. And I often wonder to myself, are we doing enough as a profession to encourage young women of color to get into journalism in the first place? So there is a supply there. Again, every time we interview, we don't get women of color applicants. So what do I need to do more outreach, or do newspapers and radio stations need to do more? Just like we criticize the local police department for not hiring enough, you know, diverse workforce. They'll say we don't have applicants, and we say, well, you need to work harder. I guess we need to work harder too.
It is hard, especially as newsroom staffs have shrunk. We have fewer positions to fill. It used to be that I would go to a job fair, for example, and look for people who I might hire over a given year, because I was always hiring about 10 people a year. And now it's so much less frequent that we do hiring that you just don't go to the job fairs, and we don't have the same internship opportunities that we used to have because of tightening of labor restrictions. So it does present a problem. By the way, talking earlier about young people wanting to get into the media, here's just an interesting statistic. The New York Times is creating a newsletter for college students and recent grads, and they were looking for 5 people, thought they might get a couple hundred applicants. 20,000 people applied for that, for those 5 positions. Isn't that amazing? So there is an appetite for information and to be a part of the information infrastructure.
Of course, full employment, very quickly, Rex, full employment is an issue because there are fewer bodies. Everybody's getting work.
Well, there you go. So that's all we have time for. We didn't hear from Murray. No. What's going on out there, Alex?
Actually, if you listen real carefully, you would have heard Murray. Not only that, he told me, because he learned to speak English a long time ago, he told me that he was not happy with the program today, so he was barking a lot.
Probably the only person on the show who doesn't want to use a newspaper right now.
No, I bet he wants to use it. He's barking because he wants to use the newspaper or something. That's The Media Project. Alan Shartok and Ian Pickus from WAMC. Judy Patter from The Daily Gazette. I'm Rex Smith from The Times Union. And here comes Pete with thanks for joining us on The Media Project.
Hold the press. Extra, extra. Read all about it. It's a mess meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people.
It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.